As moderator, I get to kick this off. So I'm going to ask you about diversity, which I think actually affects everybody here. So in the first talk, we heard that. In the second talk, we heard that diversity can be a good thing for helping us with issues of potentially. Diversity being a good thing. We heard in the first talk that that diversity can be a way of actually targeting your malware. And one can potentially say with the last talk that the more services that are deployed, the more opportunity there is for unanticipated functionality. So is software diversity helping us or harming us?
I don't really know. It's not immediately clear what we mean by software diversity, but the more interesting question, I guess, would be, well, to further that question into a probably a research agenda would be to explore trade-offs between the good and the bad and see if it, in the long term, it helps us. In the short term, it's probably questionable because the burden of having to create newer varieties and increasing the variety places huge costs on maintainers of software.
So I can talk to you about diversity in my perspective. So for the cloud proxy to work, you do need to have diversity in the sense that you have a wide variety of web services for you to pick up with. The other thing with diversity from, again, I'm saying from an attacker's perspective or from the cloud proxy's perspective, is that because if you have a wide variety of diversity, it will be very hard to define any uniform set of policies. So in that case, that opens an edge for malicious users to exploit that. So again, diversity depends on how you look at it. It could benefit both sides, from the attacker as well as the service providers.
Basically, my idea, diversity is a good thing, especially for if you want to defend, because as people already mentioned, vulnerability is unavoidable, and diversity really helps to defend, to prevent reliable exploit of vulnerabilities. Diversity definitely can be used by malware to identify hosts, but I think the main purpose of my talk is not to say, okay, malware can do this, but basically to encourage people to look into other ways, other alternative ways to solve the problem of malware. And I don't think those new techniques will be impacted by this diversity.
I'd like to add one other thing. There's several fields in which diversity is used, and one specific example where diversity, you can actually quantify diversity, say, and say it's a good thing, is in finance. In finance, diversification or diversifying your investments and hedging are two main strategies used to avoid risk. And so suppose you have a bunch of investments and you have a certain amount of money you want to invest in each of those. And also suppose that the expected payoff for each investment is the same. So if you put all your money in one investment, or you split your money up and put it in a bunch of investments, your total expected payoff will be the same. But the variance of the expected payoff in higher order measures will be higher if you diversify completely. So that's one example where we can actually say diversity is good, even though the expected payoff might be the same. In computer science, in the vulnerability literature, it's still, I guess, early to come up with an answer that precise.
So I have a question about diversity and games in particular. It seems that one thing that might not have been captured in your game is the cost of developing the diverse software, right? If I'm choosing to have something on the Mac and something on Windows, well, you know, somebody's already paid those development costs, and I can just get both, and it's effectively free to be diverse. But if I'm building something from scratch, and you're giving me a choice between developing two versions of something and developing one version of it with double the resources that I would have had, then it's a much less clear choice. And it probably, some of the work that Sandy Clark and I did suggests that where in the life cycle you are affects very much what the payoff will be. I wonder if you have looked at other game theoretic models that include a starker trade-off for when you move and when you change things. The one that comes to mind might be a Rivest's Flip It game that he presented at Crypto last year, and there may be others when you have to pay the cost of the software development as part of your game.
That's a good question. I did look at Flip It, and Flip It essentially analyzes games where it is unclear if the attacker or the defender has the control of a system. So it analyzes various cases of in game theory. But so to go back to your first question, did we analyze the cost of a developer to create several varieties? Well, I thought about it. There are two parts of diversity, like I mentioned: the number of varieties that you create and how do you distribute them. So when we first looked at diversity, we were looking at the n-version programming approach. There's a fault tolerance literature in which it suggested that you create several versions and several development teams create several versions, and they're all run simultaneously on computers, and a majority vote is taken on the correct or the wrong outputs. So question is, what is n in an n-version system? And I spent a day trying to come up with games that will capture that, but there were far too many parameters to developer cost, and it was unclear. We didn't get very far in that. But yeah, that'd be a research direction too.
Well, like NC State. So there's a number of different levels that you can place the software diversity at. And one thing I don't think I heard anything about is when you look at an enterprise and they have lots of different hosts, they want to have as much commonality as they can. They build complex systems for vulnerability management. And so their school of thought is, let's have as little diversity as possible because we can actually deploy patches faster. But there's this software diversity school of thought that says, let's change everything around, have lots of different operating systems and hosts, but that makes it much more complex to manage. So there's got to be a balance somewhere, and I know that there's some level of software diversity work of saying, let's make the same software deployed, but on each individual host, let's do some randomization. There's some benefits of that, and I was wondering if you guys could speak to the advantages and disadvantages of placing software diversity at different levels.
Okay. So randomization techniques are a clear diverse. Well, they're the obvious choice if you want to talk about diversity type differences. What they do is, with a very minimal cost to change in the way you deploy software, you can achieve diversity in the sense that every host runs software that appears to be different as far as vulnerabilities are concerned. Some work by Dan Boney and some other people have shown that in 32-bit systems, once ASLR is broken, it's just gone, that's it. There's nothing you can do. It's like a bam, you're gone kind of defense. But diversity defenses at large, I guess, presumably don't want to be a you go hit it and it fails and you can take down everything kind of defenses. So that's something to consider. As far as your first question of whether organizations want to invest a lot more money into having computers as diverse as possible, as having similarity. Well, I guess I don't know if we can actually resolve that question in a very static way. So, Paul, to give you an example, in the agricultural industry, they had wheat plantations somewhere in the 1970s, and they wanted uniformity because they wanted machines to process the wheat, and the same kind of wheat, it's easier for McDonald's to make bread, I don't know what. But there was a pest, and that damaged $1 billion worth of crop in wheat in 1 year. That's it. So, and then I guess they're diversified after that. They don't want so much damage. So, I don't know an easy answer to the question. There probably is a balance, but it's not clear if we can find that balance theoretically.
I agree on that. So, it'll be really hard to find the right balance. If you look at a similarity in the sense that you could, as you said, you can quickly patch a number of hosts if they're running similar stuff. But on the other hand, if you got infected, well, often we get infected by same virus. So, yeah. So it's really, it would be definitely good to still have certain amount of diversity, but again, like, you really have to trade off on the convenience and the diversity.
I think maybe the current randomization-based solution already have give us some balance, great balance, good balance, like ASLR. And that has been deployed, I think, by all popular operating systems from desktop to mobile. So I think runtime diversification is a good solution. And what we can do is make your software, when you build it, when you link it, to make that easier for random diversifications. For example, you can shuffle. There is a work on Auckland this year to see how to shuffle instructions to throttle the return oriented programming. And I think ASL is already a big problem for attackers. So I think a good solution should lie into use runtime diversifications, but make things that are more easier for runtime diversifications.
Yezam Bushmav, UBC. First of all, thanks for the excellent talks. I really enjoyed this session. I have a question to Mr. Song. How do you see the obfuscation techniques you develop in the paper being used in DRM?
Explain more about what do you...
So all of the techniques you show for malware to be binded to a single machine, the first instance, how do you see these techniques being used in digital rights management?
I think these techniques it's a little bit, our goal, we share a similar goal with the legitimate digital rights management system, but the techniques may be a little bit different because in legitimate DRM systems, they usually can assume they have the highest privileges. For example, most of them can like install a kernel driver or something like that, or like the Sony rootkit, or recently the Ubisoft rootkit. They call it rootkit. I don't agree it's a rootkit, but basically they can install something that has very high privileges and to get the real information. But for malware, we cannot assume that because once you are put into analysis environment, you really don't have any control over it. So any information you get may be faked. So that is one difference when designing this. And another is, as we mentioned, we cannot rely on special hardware. For legitimate DRM system, many of them may use like TPM, or many years ago use this software dock or something like that. So, but for malware, we cannot use this. And we want to, because we don't want to limit our target. So there is, I would say our technique shares a similar goal, but the approach is very different. And I think another difference is we only need to keep the uniqueness for a relatively short time, because for malware campaign, binary can usually only last for like weeks or several weeks or even several days, then it will be replaced by a new binary. So for legitimate DRM system, I think they need to make sure that the ID is really invariant for a very long time.
So this is, again, a question actually about the HIE techniques and whatnot. So one of the problems with the analysis-aware malware that's coming out is they detect whether, for example, they're in a virtual machine. And this is a problem now because you have lots of servers that are virtual machines, and so you're limiting your targets as a piece of malware. So with the HIE techniques and whatnot, if most of the machines it'll be infecting are, for example, a whole bunch of virtualized cloud services, do you see any problems with getting an actual unique host identifier, or the fact that the people performing the analysis will be able to easily essentially just flash clone the VM that's infected and instantly get the exact same setup to analyze the malware? Do you think that it'll be able to adapt and find a good set of host identifiers in an environment like that?
So first, I think... let me answer this. I think basically you have two questions. First is whether in this, for example, cloud infrastructure or virtualized environment, if there is any diversifications between different VMs. And I think, yes, there is. For example, the MAC address, or many information, yeah. And like the computer name or the username or the like the information we used if you're using Windows, the secure identifier is pretty unique. So I would say yes, there is definitely a lot of difference within a virtualized environment. I think even, for example, if you are using EC2, everyone should like may run different things. So yeah, and the second question is whether they could easily duplicate these things. I think a duplication is definitely possible, but that is involved two problems. The first is about privacy. So it's like when you're targeting, I think most malware now targeting like not this host, but really a client. So like everybody's browser use driver download to attack browsers. So for user for the client, it's really sometimes it's not very good to collect sensitive information because as a malware, they have no problem using any information as a host ID. But as a protector, sometimes it's not convenient for them to submit those information to the analysis to like the antivirus companies to say, I want to submit information so you can duplicate my host and analyze this malware. So this, I don't think people feel comfortable about this. And another problem is it's really about the network identifier. So because that is collected at the CNC server side. So to duplicate that is really like asking you to like have a analysis environment or proxy in every like state, every country, and every ISP. So that's a big problem, yeah.
Neil Somayaji at Carleton University. Ooh, that's pretty loud. I just wanted to bring up something about the SARENS model and ASLR and current diversity techniques. One funny implication of the model is that ASLR is not a diversity technique because it doesn't change the topology of the host vulnerability graph. If all it does is it makes it harder to exploit a vulnerability. So a certain subset of the vulnerabilities, those corresponding to buffer overflows and other memory corruption attacks, are now harder to get to for the attacker. And it's harder to make the transition from there to the host. But it doesn't remove them. The same number there and their connectivity to the host is exactly the same. And in fact, this is the thing about all the current randomization techniques for code randomization, other things. Once you figure out a way to bypass them on one host, that technique works on all hosts, you know, using that same defense. Now contrast this to like a virus coming into this room, you know, and try, you know, like something Ebola or something, 90% of us will die, but not all of us. And that's what diversity is in a biological context. And I think the model tries to capture that in a computer context. And the fact is, the only techniques I know of that come anywhere close to being a diversity defense are anomaly detection techniques. And even those, it's not clear how much diversity they put on systems. Otherwise, we're just talking about running different code on different systems. So I would say this opens up a research agenda of how do we make it easier to run different code on different systems, which we can't do cheaply now.
Any comments?
Well, I guess to add to that, I'm always more on the analysis side, I guess. Further research into the direction, for example, could be to somehow come up with a polynomial change in the amount of effort you put in for diversification techniques, but then that becomes an exponential change when you actually run it. So I'm hoping there's some sort of complexity theory answers lurking in there that'd be interesting to look at.
That's actually an interesting question from the standpoint of how we actually go about designing networks and large-scale systems. Is should we be essentially expecting that if we have a diversity of configurations that we're essentially, you know, giving up some certain number of we're expecting that some degree of our machines are going to go down, and then we have to go through the additional issues of trying to identify which ones they are. Things aren't uniform, patching isn't uniform, etc. So it looks like it seems like it's creating a burden on the administrator to be dealing with these plethora of potential issues, and trying to do any sort of root cause diagnosis could be potentially a lot harder as a result. Please feel free to comment. All right, let's change focus a little bit to talking about unintended functionality. So there's been a lot of work, a lot of interesting papers, and a lot of interesting work in the security community that's focused on, you know, abusing unintended functionality, and this is something that we sort of see over and over again. As soon as we look at any particular domain, it looks like there's a way to abuse it in interesting and unforeseen ways. So from the standpoint of, you know, us as people who design secure systems, how can we potentially compose systems so that we don't have these issues, or so we can mitigate these types of risks?
I think it depends. For some of the systems, it's really, really hard to predict ahead what are the possible use scenarios and interactions. So it looks like we, at least for some, say for example, for some of the web services, for one thing, it's very hard for you to predict all the scenarios ahead. For second thing, it's really very hard for you to tell whether a particular web service request is legitimate or illegal. So it looks like we still have to end it, you know, still have to leave this for a while to say that there are always some unintended functionalities, and as time goes on, some of the unintended functionality could be exploited by some malicious users, and we then just have to figure out ways to patch that.
Well, I'm going to shift gears from unintended functionality to unintended commonality that happens between software and trying to eliminate that. That probably increases diversity. So software fundamentally is written once and copied a billion times or a million times, but developers don't seem to pay attention to the fact that their software would be copied so many times. So I guess when you write software, you care about security for that particular code, but you sort of disregard the implications of a broader nature. What if my software is run on a million machines? What happens then? So I guess I'm trying to point out that aspect of transferring a software that runs on one computer, the security aspects of that, to a bunch of computers, an ecosystem of computers, is largely ignored. So maybe that's something you can focus on.
This may not be very related, but I think one thing good is the alternative ways. Like when we come up with obfuscation techniques, we look at analysis environment, can we do the opposite way? And I think this could be also true for how to detect abusing of intended functionalities. For example, as a server side, it's sometimes really hard to decide whether this request is legitimate or not. But on the opposite, maybe this is very easy at the client side. For example, I think there is research work on how to leverage the client-side functionalities to detect click fraud or something like that. So I think sometimes we need to think differently.
So I had actually a clarification on this is sort of switching gears from that a little bit. For the HIE, and so it changed the propagation model. So where does it bind to the host, right? If I'm just drive by downloads, right? These are coming to the same piece of code, right? That malware is also being copied thousands of times onto different hosts. And so if it doesn't bind until it's installed and I'm recording network traffic, can I get my samples from that and have it bind to my host that I'm analyzing?
No, I think it's changed the propagation mode a little bit, but basically most malware now does not use server-side polymorphic, but some do. So every time when every sample you get is a little different. But with HIE, what we're going to do is when the drive-by download happens, and your browser is compromised, and an intermediate downloader is downloaded. This intermediate download has a functionality of collecting the host ID, and it has embedded a one-time URL, and it will use this one-time URL to submit the host ID. And at the server side, the server will use this host ID to generate the specific malware and then deliver it to the client.
Right, because you look at it. Well, let's take a specific domain. Look at smartphones, and so they're one of the ways of delivering malware is through these application markets, right? And they don't have maybe not have that opportunity. So there are certain types of malware then that this works for, and certain types that it doesn't. And it's very dependent on how that delivery mechanism works.
Yes, I think it really depends whether do you have control of the deployment server. Right. So in drive-by download, I think it's okay. I think, for example, if you propagate from Even from intranet, it's okay. But if we are downloading things from market, a controlled marketplace, this may not be possible. But if the, like for Android, if that platform allow you to further download additional components, then it's possible.
Right, so it changes the attack a little bit. No, but it's, yeah, thanks.
Yeah.
Hi, this is a question for the last speaker. So I'm just trying to get a better sense of the scope of the threat that you outlined. So in the you essentially found a series of gadgets, web gadgets, a la ROP, and you stitched them together. Can you give a better sense of, you know, besides the functionality that you outlined with the web proxy, how powerful were the gadgets that you found? What else were you, would you have been able to do with those gadgets? And how difficult it is to find them. Like, so the success of some of the, I think you mentioned ROP-based attacks is the ability to get a diverse set of gadgets together to put together whatever functionality you need. In the case of the web services, can you speak more to the power of the technique that you've outlined here a bit?
So I think one example I mentioned is the potential denial of service attack. Because for the particular example I mentioned, it's like the HTTP range method is not respected. So that means that if you spy on a browser side, if you specify I'm going to download a certain range of the web object, that range method is only respected between the browser and the service provider. However, when service provider is going to retrieve the content, you will retrieve the entire content of it will retrieve the entire content. So therefore, you can imagine that on browser side, where you can just use much less number amount of buffer or memory space or network space to launch an attack on a website using the cloud's resource. And there's a significant asymmetricity on the capability that cloud providers or web service providers can do compared to a regular website. That's a very good question. So in fact, we are not entirely clear that whether we are lucky or not, right? Whether we're lucky in the sense that we're able to find these services, or there are web services out there, you just need to find time to dig them out. So at this time, we are unclear of whether there are web services there, you just need to find it, or it's just our luck to find this set of web service allowed us to do the following functionalities. But our belief is that given the sheer number of web services and given the fact that websites are, keep on exposing APIs, we believe that should not be that hard to find web services or functionality that you need. But again, we are not confirmed on this point yet. Sure.
So I'm curious, that the service
We tried it, but it seems that they didn't patch it so far.
So do you think it would be possible to automate the discovery of those? If you take like open source projects that are like Drupal that are using, so you can take those source word projects, can we automate going just through those code bases and try to find, here are these classes of these vulnerabilities, and we're going to look for patterns and then match those?
Great questions. This will be definitely something that we may want to look at, like you said, automatically discover web services. I would guess that it's possible in some sense that for well-documented APIs, they normally would have good documentation so that you can actually pass from there. But the other side is that once an API is well-documented, it's probably that they have tested a number of scenarios. So it will be hard to find or exploit functionality that you may need. So it's still is it will be hard to have an automated framework to do the service discovery, because the functionality you need might be available in some services that are never documented. Once a service is well documented, chances are that people have exploited all the possible holes in that services. So it will be hard to do that, but it's still is quite possible, but it will be hard.
Okay, I have a question about where you see the trends in terms of how we're creating malware and how that's happening, how that evolution is happening. It seems as though there's sort of two strands of development here that you've been talking about. One is sort of a highly targeted threat where you're looking at a specific machine and you want to make your malware essentially specified to that. Like if you look at Stuxnet, for example, there was a lot of effort put into attacking that particular reactor and trying to ensure that code didn't disseminate itself into the wild. And then conversely, these other approaches are, you know, very broad scattershot. Let's trawl as many things as possible. Do you see this as being sort of a continued bifurcation of ways of attacking systems? And do you have any other thoughts on how these things are going to evolve?
I think this difference basically represents the motivation behind the attacks. So for Stuxnet and the Flame, it's really we would say government is behind that, and it's it could be like I would say given the power of this government and resources, we would expect to see more complicated malwares. But on the other side, it's basically like organized crime or normal attackers behind the normal malwares, and for those I don't expect to see many complicated or advanced techniques, but they are really a big problem because everyone could potentially get infected. So my suggestion, or in my opinion, or the main purpose of my talk is going to say we should, because I think it's really hard to protect yourself against the first type of malware. But for the second type of malware, we should really change the current operational model, that is collect, sample, analyze system, generate signature, and use antivirus software to detect them. We really need to change this model. And I think maybe a promising, a promising approach is current to the controlled environment, like the iOS. You have a controlled market, you have a reviewer process, and once you get, you find something bad, you can really put that off. And each application running on the device is running inside a sandbox. So there isn't many capability left for malware that you can do. So I think this is a promising model, and I think by looking into things like this, we could solve the second kind of malware in the future. Yeah.
So I recollect Scott Knight from the Canadian Defense Service. I don't know which part exactly, but he gave a talk where he mentioned that that several of the systems in defense and military and other critical areas in government systems, they use crippled versions of Windows and Linux. So a regular malware, there's a good chance that might affect. And this, NSA and all of those, they always assume that all their computers are compromised by default. So this sort of historical paradigm where we write software, compile it, execute it in a very simple way, and then the distribution of software comes as an afterthought. How do we auto-update, or how do we modify existing software? That sort of a new thing that's being it's used in software community. But I suspect going in the future, or this is probably my opinion, but I suspect going in the future, we might need a more intelligent software distribution or a market model. So when you say Android market or iPhone market, it's really not just, it's just a place where people put software and then they download it. I was thinking more of an intelligent market where software package managers, for example, AppKit or Deep RPM or all of those things, they intelligently decide whether to install one alternative versus the other. So, for example, you might want to install OpenSSL library, or you might want to install GNU TLS library, and you can actually go and do either of them depending on your choice. And Linux distributions ship with one or the other, or probably both. And suppose they're API level compatible, then your package manager itself can go to the market and look at what the security track records of each of these things are, and then install install software, and you can probably have something like what happens in finance, where you have algorithms trading, you have software package managers trading in a huge market. So it's more of an intelligent free market way of probably distributing software, and that will hopefully reduce the effect of large scale effect of one malware affecting a whole bunch of systems. And maybe if defense or military systems have different markets that don't connect to your regular software, that don't source from your regular code repository, then it might be possible to at least separate out things like Stuxnet or Flame versus regular attacks.
I just want to add one point. I think this probably is one benefit of having open sourcing. So once you have all the source open and contributed by everyone, carefully reviewed by everyone, this probably would reduce the chance of a malware.
We'll open up the floor one final time. Does anybody have any questions? Are you willing to answer? If not, then I'd like to thank our speakers and thank you for attending the session.